Hello, this is On the Case from EG, the podcast that gives you the essential detail on recent property cases. This week, I'm joined by Michael Padgett, a barrister at Cornerstone Barristers, who acted in the Rock Advertising case. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Sarah.
Michael, thanks very much for joining us today to discuss the recent Supreme Court decision in Rock Advertising Limited versus MWB Business Exchange Centres Limited and what it means for property practitioners. Now, to set the scene, Rock Advertising was a contract law case dealing with an oral variation. Can you outline what, in general terms, that entails?
Yes, most contracts, certainly contracts in a property context, are written contracts, but there can be oral contracts. You can have a tenancy agreement that is not in writing. And what you can also do is you can vary the terms orally. Mm-hmm. And the case that we're considering all dealt with when you can and when you can't vary terms orally, and how can parties protect themselves against variations that they're unaware of, or they haven't authorised, or they are lacking in any detail.
The Rock Advertising case raised two particular issues. Can you explain for our listeners what were those two issues?
Yes. The licence agreement in the Rock Advertising case had a term, which is a standard term in a lot of written agreements, that says there should be no oral modification, which is called a nom clause.
Right.
So if the parties want to vary the contract in any way, they have to comply with the mechanism in the nom clause, which normally includes having it all set out in writing and sometimes includes the parties signing it as well. The question in the case was whether or not that mechanism can actually be overridden orally by the parties. And if the parties then enter into an oral variation, if they can do that, what amounts to consideration for an oral variation? Because, as listeners will remember, contract is all based in English and Welsh law on offers, acceptance and consideration. And if you've got a variation, what's the consideration for the variation? That is something that has been troubling a lot of judges and a lot of academics. And the practical benefit consideration is probably not a very useful solution to that.
In this particular case, do you want to talk us through the facts and what they're actually dealing with?
This was a license agreement for serviced offices. Mm-hmm. And MWB was the licensor. They let out offices to people, including Rock Advertising. Rock Advertising had been one of their very loyal clients. They'd moved from some offices into larger offices. They entered into a license agreement, but they probably overreached themselves. They got into arrears. And so then they went to MWB and said, look, can we reschedule the arrears that we've already accrued over the remaining term of the license? This was agreed by an employee of MWP, and she had the authority to do this. And Rock then paid monies in accordance with the variation. However, in the license agreement, there was a nom clause. Ironically, in this particular case, Rock hadn't even signed the license agreement itself, but what it did say in the nom clause is any variation needs to be in writing.
Right.
So when it came to trial, the trial judge found that the employee did have authority to vary, that there was a variation, and that this created practical benefit for the licensor, because a bird in the hand, the prospect of getting some of the arrears, was mm-hmm. better than two birds in the bush.
Okay.
That was a practical benefit. But the trial judge found that the nom clause meant that this agreement didn't bind MWB.
Right. So you mention the trial judge. Do you want to talk us through the case's journey all the way to the Supreme Court?
Yes. Yes, it's a very interesting journey, because what happened then was it was appealed by Rock and was successfully appealed. It was very fortunate for Rock that their appeal arrived in the Court of Appeal just after another case called Globe Motors
right.
had been determined by the Court of Appeal, dealing with NOM clauses generally.
Mm-hmm.
And in Globe Motors, which was applied by the Court of Appeal in the Rock case, the Court of Appeal had said that NOM clauses can be overridden by the parties. Mm-hmm. If the parties, at a later stage, do a deal and say, yes, we want to orally vary and we want to ignore the NOM clause, then that is binding. The reason they did that is because they said that party autonomy, the contracting party's ability to change their minds about things, trumped the original terms of the contract.
Right.
So this was a great opportunity for Lady Justice Arden to find in this particular case that the NOM clause wasn't binding. And that was attractive because she could then say that practical consideration, practical benefit, is a good consideration. She has expressed a number of different academic articles real concerns about consideration, which is consistent with a lot of academics that say that consideration is perhaps something that is outdated in modern English and Welsh contract law.
You mention academics and members of the judiciary wrestling with these questions over some period of time. What's been the court's general approach to dealing with this sort of case?
Completely inconsistent on NOM clauses. And I've just been talking about Globe and the fact that the timing was perfect for this case in the Court of Appeal because Globe had just come out. But Globe was the last, prior to Rock Advertising, of about six or seven cases coming out of the Court of Appeal which were completely inconsistent. Some saying the NOM clause trumps everything.
Mm-hmm.
If you go into an agreement in the first place and you want a certain amount of formality, certain contractual agreements have to have formality by way of statute, and property lawyers will be well aware of that in a property context. But if you as contracting parties decide we want more formality, then that should trump everything else. By contrast, a number of other cases had said no, party autonomy trumps that, that if at a later date you decide to change things, you should be allowed to do that. Why should your contracting powers be of a special higher status when you enter into the contract than later on down the line when the circumstances of the commercial circumstances may have changed and you want to change the contract? This all goes back to not just the fundamentals of property law, but as listeners will remember, the fundamentals of that first or second lecture that they had in contract law at university. All the stuff about can you contract to be a slave? Can you contract to do things for the rest of the time of the contract, or should you be allowed to resile from that?
So an opportunity then for the Supreme Court to give some definitive guidance in this area. What did they hold?
They found that NOM clauses do trump later variations if those variations don't comply with the NOM mechanism. That the contracting parties do have some sort of enhanced contracting power at the point that they enter into the contract. And that if they seek to vary the contract in any other way but by way of the NOM clause, it will be invalid in law. So this is quite a radical step. They come full square down on one side of the debate that's been going on in English and Welsh courts and in the common law as a whole. They find that the debate about party autonomy is misguided and is a bit of a fallacy because a number of contracts have requirements that bind the parties thereafter. That's the whole rationale of a contract. You enter into an agreement which fetters your ability in the future because you're bound by the contract. And a NOM clause, they say, is no different to that. And if you've agreed to be bound by a NOM clause, you need to follow the terms of the NOM clause. What that means is that unless you comply with the NOM clause, the only way that any other variation will be binding on the parties is if there's been a stopple. If it's just not fair after a course of conduct for the parties to say, oh, well, I didn't agree that oral variation. The difficulty, however, with that is that Lord Sumption, though Lord Sumption says in his opening paragraphs this is an exceptional case, what he doesn't then do when describing the estoppel is assist practitioners, because he says you can only get estoppel in this situation, not just by way of the detriment or the unconscionable conduct, but for some reason, he says, you also have to explicitly reference the nom clause. There is no reason in equity why the nom clause has to be referenced, and it's difficult to understand that comment. It is obiter to this case, but it is difficult to understand why right. He has restricted the estoppel in that way.
Looking ahead, how should our listeners interpret and apply this case in practice?
Nom clauses now have superpowers. If you have a nom clause in your contract, you need to comply with the nom clause. There's a mechanism, you just follow the mechanism. This is creating certainty for the parties, because it means that there's no risk of one party saying, oh, I orally varied, and these are the terms of the oral variation. Often you can get disputes about what the precise terms of any oral variation were. And also it avoids the risk of, in large organisations, the inability to properly police their own contracts. So it makes complete commercial sense. It enhances certainty. It is a little bit debatable about whether the Supreme Court should have made that big jump in the majority. Lord Briggs in the minority says that these clauses aren't necessarily invalid if varied orally. And he says that the development of the English common law should be incremental. In contrast, the majority have made a big jump, but it is a big jump that's been prompted by commercial good sense. However, unfortunately, what they didn't do is take the opportunity to deal with the second question. Because they dealt with the first question in that way, the second question was obiter. Namely, the practical benefit consideration issues and the issues that Lady Justice Arden has been highlighting for a number of years. Lord Sumption recognises that it's due for reconsideration. It is a ridiculous rule that if a person is owed £100, that they can't agree with the person that owns the money, that they could be paid just £80. But they can agree to pay £80 and a peppercorn and a chocolate wrapper and some other type of consideration. The problem that has arisen in relation to consideration is the debt cases that Folks and Beer and Reselect Move have come out of have infected contract cases generally. And there doesn't seem to be any good public policy reason why a contracting party can't agree, if they're owed £100, just to accept £80 on the debt. It's disappointing that the Supreme Court didn't take this opportunity, because it's pretty unlikely that it's going to crop up in the Supreme Court again very soon.
Okay. And just to wind up then, if there were three tips that you could offer our listeners for avoiding issues with oral variation in the future, what would you say to them?
I'll say the same word three times. To paraphrase Tony Blair, put it in writing, put it in writing, put it in writing. At the moment, a lot of our listeners may well be dealing with shop renegotiations on their tenancies. And if there's any dispute, that can be avoided if it's all in writing and all compliant with the nom clause.
Michael Padgett, thank you very much indeed.